before independence had been declared. Before William Barrett Travis's famous victory or death letter had been penned. Before the Mexican army had stormed the defenses of the Alamo. Before the bloodshed at Goliad. Before the legends and myths of Texas were fully formed, nothing was certain. The future, our history, was unwritten and rested fully in the hands of the people living in what is now the state of Texas. Samuel Houston had issued an energetic call to the people of Texas back on December 12, 1835, long before the Alamo and Goliad. Houston wrote, "Your situation is peculiarly calculated to call forth all your manly energies. Under the Republican Constitution of Mexico, you were invited to Texas, then a wilderness. You have reclaimed and rendered it a cultivated country. You solemnly swore to support the Constitution and its laws. Your oaths are yet inviolate. In accordance therewith, you have fought with the liberals against those who sought to overthrow the Constitution in 1832, when the present usurper was the champion of liberal principles in Mexico. Your obedience has manifested your integrity. You have witnessed with pain the convulsions of the interior and a succession of usurpations. You have experienced in silent grief the expulsion of your members elect from the state Congress. You have realized the horrors of anarchy and the dictation of military rule. The promises made to you have not been fulfilled. Your memorials for the redress of grievances have been disregarded. And the agents you have sent to Mexico have been imprisoned for years without enjoying the rights of trial agreeably to law. Your constitutional executive has been deposed by the bayonets of a mercenary soldiery, while your Congress has been dissolved by violence, and its members either fled or were arrested by the military force of the country. The Federation has been dissolved, the Constitution declared at an end, and centralism has been established. Amid all these trying vicissitudes, you remained loyal to the duty of citizens, with the hope that liberty would not perish in the Republic of Mexico. But while you were fondly cherishing this hope, the dictator required the surrender of the arms of the civic militia, that he might be enabled to establish on the ruins of the Constitution a system of a policy which would forever enslave the people of Mexico. Zacatecas, unwilling to yield her sovereignty to the demand which struck at the root of all liberty, refused to disarm her citizens of their private arms. Ill-fated state! Her power, as well as her wealth, aroused the ambition of Santa Anna and excited his cupidity. Her citizens became the first victims of his cruelty, while her wealth was sacrificed in payment for the butchery of her citizens. The success of the usurper determined him in exacting from the people of Texas submission to the central form of government, and to enforce his plan of despotism, he dispatched a military force to invade the colonies and exact the arms of the inhabitants. The citizens refused the demand, and the invading force was increased. The question then was, shall we resist the oppression and live free, or violate our oaths and bear a despot's stripes? The citizens of Texas rallied to the defense of their rights. They have met 4-1, and by their chivalry and courage have vanquished the enemy with a gallantry and spirit which is characteristic of the justice of our cause. The army of the people is now before Bejar, besieging the central army within its walls. Though called together at the moment, the citizens of Texas, unprovided as they were in the necessary munitions of war and supplies for an army, have maintained a siege for months, always patient and untiring in their patriotism and zeal in the cause of liberty. They have borne every vicissitude of season and every incident of the soldier with a contempt of peril which reflects immortal honor on the members of the army of the people. Since our army has been in the field, a consultation of the people by their representatives has met and established a provisional government. This course has grown out of the emergencies of the country. The army has claimed its peculiar care. We are without law and without a constitutional head. Revisional Executive and the General Counsel of Texas are earnestly engaged in the discharge of their respective duties, preparing for every exigency of the country, and I am satisfied from their zeal, ability, and patriotism that Texas will have everything to hope from their exertions in behalf of the principles which we have avowed. A regular army has been created, and liberal encouragement has been given by the government. To all who will enlist for 2 years or during the war, a bounty of $24 and 800 acres of land will be given. Provision has also been made for raising an auxiliary volunteer corps to constitute part of the Army of Texas, which will be placed under the command and subject to the orders of the Commander-in-Chief. The field for promotion will be open. The terms of service will be various. To those who tender their services for or during the war will be given a bounty of 640 acres of land. An equal bounty will be given to those who volunteer their services for 2 years, if for 1 year a bounty of 320 acres, and to those who may volunteer for a shorter period, a no bounty of land will be given, but the same liberal pay, rations, etc. will be allowed them as other members of the Army. The rights of citizenship are extended to all who will unite with us in defending the Republican principles of the Constitution of 1824. Citizens of Texas, your rights must be defended. The oppressors must be driven from our soil. Submission to the laws and union among ourselves will render us invincible. Subordination and discipline in our army will guarantee to us victory and renown. Our invader has sworn to exterminate us or sweep us from the soil of Texas. He is vigilant in his work of oppression and has ordered to Texas 10,000 men to enforce the unhallowed purposes of his ambition. His letters to his subalterns in Texas have been intercepted, and his plans for our destruction are disclosed. Departing from the chivalric principles of civilized warfare, he has ordered arms to be distributed to a portion of our population for the purpose of creating, in the midst of us, a servile war. The hopes of the usurper were inspired by a belief that the citizens of Texas were disunited and divided in opinion. That alone has been the cause of the present invasion of our rights. He shall realize the fallacy of his hopes in the union of her citizens and their eternal resistance to his plans against constitutional liberty. We will enjoy our birthright or perish in its defense. A lot of interesting statements there made by Houston that we'll dig deeper into the future. But Houston closed the proclamation by saying this: the services of 5,000 volunteers will be accepted. By the 1st of March next, we must meet the enemy with an army worthy of our cause and which will reflect honor upon freemen. Our habitations must be defended. The sanctity of our hearths and firesides must be preserved from pollution. Liberal Mexicans will unite with us. Our countrymen in the field have presented an example worthy of imitation. Generous and brave hearts from a land of freedom have joined our standard before Béjar. They have, by their heroism and valor, called forth the admiration of their comrades in arms and have reflected additional honor on the land of their birth. Let the brave rally to our standard. Sam Houston departed the convention in Washington on the Brazos and arrived in Gonzales on March 11, 1836. A lot had happened since he sent out his proclamation calling for an army of 5,000 to rise and gather to defend the rights of the people of Texas. News also arrived that day that the Alamo had fallen and all of its defenders were dead. Over 180 men shot, stabbed, and bludgeoned to death, then burned and turned to ash and bone by fire. Dead in the end, but they exacted a toll and went into fury and legend. Though a group of Texans had declared independence on March 2nd, on March 11th they were very far away from its reality. In fact, it seemed their cause was on the verge of doom. That very day, Houston sent word to Fannin at Goliad to withdraw east towards Victoria. Fannin did not withdraw until March 19th, and after the Battle of Coleto Creek, he and his men were taken back to Goliad. And when Houston arrived in Gonzales, he did not find the army of 5,000 that he had called for back in December. Instead, he found a little less than 400 men there, 374 men by one account I've seen, gathered in Gonzales, ready to go to the aid of Travis, Bowie, Crockett, and the other Alamo defenders. Houston could have done just that. Many of the men wanted to go and exact vengeance then. But it doesn't take a genius to realize that even with double the men, the odds were in favor of Santa Anna and his much larger force. They would more than likely suffer the same fate as the Alamo defenders if they were to take that course of action. And where were the 5,000 men Houston had called for? The historian George Bancroft estimated that when the revolution started in late 1835, the population of Texas was at about 50,000. The United States emissary to Texas in 1836, a man named Henry Mason Morfitt, reported that the population of Texas was at about 58,500, including about 35,000 people that had originated in the United States. And that number is about 30,000 Anglos and 5,000 enslaved people, 14,000 to 20,000 Native Americans, and about 3,500 Native Mexicans. The question as to why the army of 5,000 men did not materialize out of that population is an interesting one, and it's one that I'm not going to be diving into here today. It's a puzzle that has many pieces to answer, and if you would like to help me in answering that, then drop me an email at texashistorylessons@gmail.com. But before moving on, there is another interesting comment from J. Frank Dobie. Dobie notes in The Flavor of Texas the following, quote, "When the Texas Revolution began, there were perhaps 25,000 English-speaking souls in Texas. How many of the men of this number were ever at one time enlisted in the Texas Army is not known. The number constantly fluctuated. The muster rolls are incomplete. One thing is certain, a majority of the army men were not Texas settlers. A majority of them were young men who had come to Texas to fight for their rights. Only about a dozen men claiming Texas as home were, for instance, in the Goliad massacre of over 350 men. Probably about one-fifth of the heroes of San Jacinto were at the time bona fide residents of Texas." Interesting. And I'm not casting aspersions on anyone here or attacking anybody's history. Dobie's numbers give weight to Santa Anna's claim that the bulk of those he was fighting were what he considered pirates or foreign invaders, invaders to whom which the Tournelle Decree applied. Now, if you have any thoughts and evidence to help answer this question, then please, again, send me an email and I'll address this much closer, taking a lot of time to look into it at a future time in a future episode. So, in addition to only having about 374 men to make up his army, those men were poorly organized. They were poorly supplied and they were poorly armed. And they had less than 2 days' provisions to sustain them. Many of them didn't even have weapons to fight with in the upcoming confrontations. And many of those that were armed, they didn't have ammunition. If he were able to delay and increase the size of his army, if he were able to improve their discipline, if he were able to increase the supplies for his men, and if he were to make sure they were properly equipped for battle, and that's a lot of ifs, then he might tilt the odds a little bit in favor of the rebels' favor. If he were able to coordinate or join forces with Fannin and his force of over 300, then they stood more of a fighting chance. On March 13th, Houston learned that General Joaquin Ramirez y Sesma and about 700 soldiers had been dispatched by Santa Anna towards Gonzales with the goal of capturing and more than likely killing Houston and his men, which is the fate suffered by Colonel Fannin and about 350 of his men on March 27th, 1836. So, learning this, Houston made a decision that angered many. He burned Gonzales to the ground and ordered a retreat with a rear guard shepherding the settlers that were fleeing eastward also. But things had not gone as Houston had anticipated. Santa Anna had pushed northward earlier than expected. Then the siege of the Alamo had occurred, independence was declared, a scheme to march south and seize Matamoros had been launched. Fannin had made missteps, surrendered, and been executed. And when Houston had arrived at Gonzales, he did not really have an army. A handwritten note on the broadside of his December proclamation that is part of the Mirabeau Lamar papers in the archives of the Texas State Library and Archives Commission reads as follows. Houston's first appearance in the field was March 12, 1836, without a single regular soldier. Some 400 Texas volunteers conducted his army at Gonzales by the 15th of the same month. And by the time Houston had arrived in Burnham's Ferry on the Colorado River near LaGrange on March 17th, he'd gathered a couple of hundred more men, making his little army about 600 in number. The army and the retreating refugees crossed, and he had the ferry destroyed. Many of his men were furious. They wanted to fight. They wanted to exact revenge. And he considered it, but when the news of the mass execution at Goliad arrived, he determined to push eastward towards the Brazos. Houston set out on March 26, 1836, despite the complaints of his soldiers. Upon arriving at San Felipe on March 27, 1836, he was faced with the refusals of Captains Mosley Baker and Wiley Martin to retreat any farther. Houston faced the defiance and found a solution by giving them what they wanted. If they wanted to fight, they could. He said they could stand and fight, each with a company of men, Baker at the San Felipe crossing and Martin at the Fort Benz crossing about 30 miles down the Colorado. So Houston then proceeded 20 miles upstream to camp on the west side of the Brazos across from Gross's plantation, where he spent almost 2 weeks gaining provisions, reorganizing the Texas fighting force, and drilling the much inexperienced soldiers. The Alamo had fallen, and over 180 men had died defending it. Gonzales had been burned to the ground, and Houston's small command was retreating eastward. Fannin and over 300 more were executed at Goliad. These were horrific events for the population living in Texas. They were horrific events for the people that were killed, of course, and based on some primary resources I've read, it was horrific for some, if not many, of those that had performed the killings. Like many disasters or horrific events we hear about today in the news, the bigger the number of deaths and the farther away it occurs, then the less personal it is. In history, it is even more distant. But tragedy and horror were just as real and severe in the 1830s as it is now. Santa Anna's actions were designed to punish what he considered an illegitimate foreign invasion to usurp Mexican sovereignty and his authority. And this was not an anomaly. He wasn't suddenly a monster that spread unnecessary bloodshed. There was a history of violence that preceded him and often happened after him. Santa Anna's goal was to instill a spirit of fear in anyone who considered supporting it. And he got what he wanted. Fear and terror spread like wildfire. Instilling the fear and terror had not been without some cost. It had not been easy to raise his sizable force, and the Battle of the Alamo had cost the Mexican army at least a combined total of 600 wounded and dead. At least 300 to 400 Mexican men would not be welcomed home by their loved ones. And here's a brief tangent. I recently found a master's thesis in history from 1966 written by Tina Flannery at the North Texas State University that touches on these thoughts. She wrote in 1966, quote, of the thinking regarding the Mexican army sent to crush the Texan Revolution has been influenced by biased writers and historians who have unjustly pictured the dictator as the personification of that army. In the minds of many Texans then and now, Santa Anna and his army merged as one, moving swiftly and viciously across Texas to commit atrocities against Americans who were defending their rights. The description of Santa Anna and his hatred of meddlesome foreigners, his ungovernable temper, and his disregard for the niceties of war became a blanket description of his men. Like Cadmus's men, they appeared to spring from one source for one purpose, and were always at the place where there was an enemy to destroy. By concentrating on the commander and vilifying him as he deserved, the riders lost sight of the subordinates as people and the problems entailed with supplying and moving the Mexican army. End quote. And that's an interesting thing. You can actually look it up and find it easily online if you're interested in reading this thesis. And so the deaths at Goliad would be troublesome for him in his future in Mexico. It would be part of the views that we have of him even today. And the events at both San Antonio de Bejar and Goliad would be a problem for him in his immediate future in Texas. In retrospect, he was lucky to escape with his life to return to be a force later on in Mexico. Yet at this specific point, Santa Anna had once again been victorious and pressed on to finalize his crushing message to foreign interlopers. News of these events and the terror they created launched a mass exodus of Texans eastward towards the United States. The goal of a large part of the non-participant population was to get away as fast as possible from the Mexican army. Thus began the event that is called the Runaway Scrape. People abandoned their farms and many of their belongings and fled east, and this was not an easy task. Travel was hard, and to make it harder, it was a rainy spring, and the roads, simple as they were, turned to bogs. Noah Smithwick saw the aftermath of the people's flight, described it as this. Houses were standing open, the beds unmade, the breakfast things still on the tables, pans of milk molding in the dairies. There were cribs full of corn, smokehouses full of bacon, yards full of chickens that ran after us for food, nests of eggs in every fence corner, all abandoned.
You are listening to Texas History Lessons, a slow walk through Texas history made in Texas by a Texan for everyone everywhere.
That's going to do it for this episode. We'll be taking a look at some firsthand accounts from other people involved in the Runaway Scrape in the next couple of episodes. And then we'll look at some firsthand accounts of the Battle of San Jacinto. Thanks for listening. Thanks to Derek McLennan for providing the theme music for Texas History Lessons. As I've said earlier, you can reach me at texashistorylessons@gmail.com. Your thoughts and contributions and advice would be welcome. So we'll see you soon. Take care of yourself. Take care of each other. Be kind. Adios.